Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have two very esteemed guests, one who is returning to the podcast, Michelle Sherman, and for the first time, her mom, Deanne, is making her debut on the Teaching Journeys podcast. So let me tell you a little bit about both of them. Michelle is a clinical psychologist who has dedicated her 30-plus year career to supporting families dealing with a mental illness or history of trauma. She was named the American Psychological Association's Family Psychologist of the Year in 2022. Michelle has served as a therapist for over 30 years, providing individual and couple psychotherapy to adults in a VA medical center, urban primary care clinic, community clinic, inpatient psychiatric unit, and private practice. As an educator, she served as a full professor at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center and the University of Minnesota Medical School, teaching and supervising trainees from numerous disciplines. She's an accomplished speaker, having given over 250 workshops nationally and internationally. She also enjoys volunteering, serving on the board of the Oklahoma National Alliance on Mental Illness for 14 years and currently volunteering with the Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness affiliate. She's published over 75 articles in peer-reviewed journals, over 80 book chapters and articles in other sources, and 4 books for the lay public. Now, introducing her mom, Deanne Sherman. Deanne is a mental health advocate and educator. She graduated from St. Catherine University in St. Paul, Minnesota, with degrees in French, education, and speech and theater. She volunteers with the National Association of Mental Illness Alliance in Minnesota, gives workshops with her daughter about mental illness in the family, and mentors people of all ages in the performing arts as a choreographer. Deanne's mission is to educate and empower others. She has strong passions for combating stigma, offering hope to people who are hurting, celebrating diversity, and promoting open discussion about mental health. Deanne and Michelle, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been excited about getting the two of you together for a long time.
Thank you so much. We're so happy to be here and appreciate your patience that Mom wasn't able to be here last time, but we are just delighted that we both are able to be with you here this morning. Thanks, Dave.
Well, you're quite welcome. And for those who are listening today in my audience, you might recall Michelle was a guest on the Teaching Journeys podcast, I think at some point, the latter part of last year, I believe. We had a great conversation about what you do with families that are dealing with mental illness. And, you know, you just gave us a great overview. And I'm excited to have your mom on the show today so that we could talk about, among other things, your book, I'm Not Alone. So, Deanne, again, welcome. And I'm just so grateful that you're able to be here today.
Thank you, Dave. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So thanks for being patient and waiting until I was able to be here, join you and my daughter. It's a wonderful way to start a Sunday morning.
Well, thank you. This is a great way to start my Sunday morning is talking with a really dynamic mother and daughter team who work to help, you know, address mental illness in teens and with families. So let's get right down to it. I'm going to ask both of you, and you can, whoever wants to start can. What drew both you and Deanne to the mental health field?
Yeah, so I was a math major in college. And part of me likes the numbers and the order and the right and wrong and that sort of stuff. But I couldn't understand linear algebra. Could not understand that. And B, I did not feel like I was really using my gifts, Dave, honestly. I just didn't feel like I was able to make a difference. volunteerism has been a big part of my life that my parents fostered for a long time. And so I've had a lot of opportunities from, you know, candy striping to homeless shelters and things for my whole life, including when I was in college. I really had the privilege of serving to volunteer with people in the hospital after they'd had a sexual assault. I started a sexual assault support group and so was able to do a lot of things. I'm like, okay, I think I like this. And so I ended up pursuing psychology and never turned back. The ability to use my psychological services and ideas in a lot of different ways. Now I'm just restarting volunteering with the American Red Cross to help people after disaster sort of stuff. So the ability to use that in a variety of ways has really been meaningful for me. Not that I don't use my math major ideas sometimes, certainly. It can be helpful with statistics and things, but that's my path. So, Mom?
My path began in 2004 at the lake where we go every year on vacation. And I was in the living room of our little, you know, cabin, a beautiful lake in northern Minnesota. And Michelle walked in the room and said, Mom, you want to write a book with me? And I said, honey, I'd love to do anything with you, but what did you just? And so that was my introduction to psychology. And what drew me to writing was an invitation from my daughter. And so we ended up writing two books in 2005, 2006, one for the precursor to what we are going to talk about later, one, a guide for teens who have a parent with a mental illness. The other book was for teens who have a parent with PTSD. And actually, we wrote a third book in that same era, and it's called My Story, that is for military teens. So that's what drew me to this whole mental health section, because as you said, my degrees are in French and theater, but I also have that whole education piece that I bring to our writing, and we found that to be really useful, especially when Michelle writes something and I go, Michelle, I have no idea what you wrote, and I don't even care. This isn't important. Let's get these facts and all this research out of here, because people don't care, because she still has that, you know, math component inside of her. But that's how I became a part of this amazing journey of mental wellness and mental health.
Yeah, those are two very diverse paths, but I think they intersect. I know for a lot of young adults, creative means, dance, movement, all of that really helps them with a lot of specific mental health conditions. I know dance therapy specifically helps young teenagers who have challenges with eating disorder. So I think though the two of you have very different paths, they intersect in quite a creative way, I think, to really help teens and families address their needs in very creative fashion. So I think what you two do singularly and together is great.
Thank you, Dave.
You're
welcome.
Thank you. And Michelle, I got to share with you, I was, when I started out in college, I was a medical technology major. I was going to be a phlebotomist. Well, here's the funny part about this is that my guidance counselor in high school said, you want to get a, take a major in college that's going to, you know, provide you for a job with a job. So he suggested medical technology, except organic chemistry was so foreign to me that drove me into the field of psychology. But like you, I have no practical need for organic chemistry in my whole life. But math, I can see it can be a serviceable skill.
That's so hilarious. I hear you. I know. Yeah. Things lead us in interesting ways, don't they, Dave?
Yeah, they sure do. It's just, we never have control over, I think, the paths our lives are going to take. It's just whenever path opens up, we have to be aware enough to explore it and see where it leads.
That's right. Exactly.
So one of the things that I've been really interested in lately is I teach for at least this one semester a family stress and coping course. And we talk about all type of stressors that impact families, you know, that can impact, you know, how the children grow up, you know, and other types of issues that can occur within the family. And one of the things that I've been very passionate about, and I tell my students in all my classes, early experience matters. Adverse childhood experiences, the sooner that there's early intervention with those experiences, the sooner families and individuals can reclaim the narrative. So I was extremely interested in terms of talking with you about I'm Not Alone. So tell us a little bit about your book, I'm Not Alone, which the full title is I'm Not Alone, A Teen's Guide to Living with a Parent Who Has a Mental Illness or History of Trauma. I know the first printing was in July of 2006. And he did an updated version or edition in October of last year, 2024. So tell us about the book, what you want teens and families and just readers in general to take away from it.
Yeah. I'd like to make a comment on your first comment, though. It's such a great setup. I've thought of, you know, naming some of my talks like The Invisible Ace. Because certainly when we think about the ACEs, we think about abuse and neglect and parental substance abuse and all these sorts of things. And obviously all of them are very important and many of them are quite prevalent. But even if we just take, for example, parental substance abuse for a second, and again, it's about the same prevalence actually as parental mental illness. You know, about 1 in 4, 1 in 5 kids have a parent with mental illness. But if we look at the sharp contrast, Dave, and this is part of my entree into answering your question, you know, we have ALET teen, you know, support groups. We even have a name there, you know, COA, Children of Addiction, where we have organizations, National Association of Children of Addiction, things like that. We don't have anything for kids whose parents have mental illness. There's no name. There's no organization. There's certainly no support groups in the United States for them consistently. So to us, a large part of why we wrote this verse book and then revised it in last year, as you said, was because there is a huge gap in resources. You know, there are books for the person with the illness, there are books for family members, but there really aren't any books for these young people. And so we are very passionate about trying to raise awareness of this ACE, of this adverse childhood experience, not only to help them be identified, help them be seen, help them be known, but also, as I hope we'll get a chance to talk about today, the science of prevention resilience is rich. There are a lot of things that we can do to help these young people. We do know, of course, the research shows, particularly with parental depression, bipolar disorder, there is about a 50% chance that the child will develop some sort of mental illness, lifetime prevalence. But that's only 50%. And with parental psychosis, it's about 20% chance that the offspring will develop an illness at some point in their lives. But that's not 100%, okay? And so there are certainly many things that we know about how to support these children and families. So how can we identify? How can we either do prevention or early intervention? That's a huge part of our passion and drivenness for working in this area. Mom, do you want to make any comments about kind of your thoughts of why this is important?
Because I don't think there was anything else out there. There wasn't anything else there in 2005, 2006. That's why you wrote it. And as far as we can tell, and we have to have that caveat, there isn't anything now for these children. So while we were writing our other book that I think you talked about with Dave last time, for adults who have a loved one managing a mental illness, we said, why don't we just bring these other two books, you know, up to date and do this? Because we can't find anything out there. So we still don't think there is. I think these children are just, you know, kind of neglected, forgotten about. And I think sometimes the person with the mental illness and the caregiver or the well parent are so busy, so invested, so caught up in what's going on with them that I actually heard a caregiver say in all of this, I forgot about the kids. I just forgot about the kids. And I think a lot of areas do, whether they're teachers, and Michelle, you've said in a class of 30, maybe there would be 6 or 7 students who have a parent managing a mental illness. But of course, the kids hide this. They protect themselves and don't let a lot of people in because for a lot of reasons. But they need to be seen and recognized and supported by a lot of different people. And that's part of our goal, Dave.
Yeah, and I think, one, the supportive community, however we define that community to help teens and families navigate their challenges is so important. I think, you know, Michelle and I have probably talked about this before in our first episode, is the lack of resources nationwide. I mean, I'm a retired addictions professional myself, and in the 27 years that I was employed, we always had a resource issue. There was always more individuals that needed treatment than there were resources to provide it. And from what I can see now, that still hasn't changed. We're still struggling, which is why you're seeing mental health coaches, why you're seeing more support groups, why you're seeing books like you and Michelle write that are so important in terms of how can we be supportive? How can we understand? What can we do as a preventative piece And I think there's needs to be more money sunk into prevention.
I think I'm also, I fully agree. And certainly this generation of young people are much more tech savvy. They're much more open to talking about mental illness and that sort of stuff, which I think is good, mental health at least. And I also am very cautious because we know that a lot of the information posted on, say, TikTok or Instagram or things is actually not accurate. And so part of what I think makes our work different is that I'm a clinical psychologist, done therapy 30 years, and everything I do is very research-based. And so it's people can trust that what they get from us is going to be based in science, as opposed to, again, when the research studies found that about half of the stuff in this study on TikTok had inaccuracy. It was providing wrong information. So we have to be careful.
Deanne, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I think my daughter did a great job.
Mom, why don't you comment on our process that we thought it was going to be really easy to update, and then what happened? I'm not alone from version one to version two.
Well, we thought we would just, update a couple things, add a few, quotes, change some of the little graphics that we had. But my goodness, we had to rewrite the whole thing. We had, a lot has changed, Dave, in 20 years, including our readers. They know, like Michelle was just saying, they know a lot more about mental health. They talk about it with all the crises that are happening in the world. They just have to talk about it. And the counselors that come to school to support the students. So they're just a lot more aware, plus the whole stuff online, which Michelle said is good and not so good. And we had over 20 young teen readers read our book and give us feedback. And man, oh man, they were honest. And they told us a lot of really cool things. And a young student who was going into seventh grade, and as this child was giving us feedback, they said, don't forget about the concept of giving grace. And Michelle and I looked at each other and we said, oh my gosh, we have not included that in either book. And we had many professionals review both books, and 30 or 40 professionals, and no one had come up with a concept of grace except this young person going into seventh grade. So we put it in both books. What does it mean to give grace, and what does it not mean to be careful of protecting yourself? So we just had to write a whole new book because so much has changed, and we included a lot of the old stuff, but a whole lot of new stuff that, in fact, in preparation for this podcast, Dave, I read the book again last night because you could write it, but forget what's, I'm so darn impressed. I just read it and I thought, what a bunch of good stuff. What a bunch of good, simple, information. What is mental health? What causes it? And then how does a child take care of themselves? How do they manage their friends? Do they tell their friends? We walked them through the process of telling their friends about their whole life, if they so choose. What about that? How do they get their support network? How do they build on that? And who can they go to? And their circle of control. What can they control? What do they have no control over? And then, of course, it was my niece who said, well, Aunt Dee, my friends just want to know, am I going to get it? And Michelle said, Mom, that's a really important question. I think we need to do a whole chapter on that. So our final chapter is basically, am I going to get it? And resilience and early warning signs. And so you put it all together, and I was just really, I'm going to say, proud of what we did, having read it kind of with a clear mind, last night, because I hadn't looked at it.
Well, the fact of the matter is, you got professional input, you got young adult input. That's the best kind of collaboration to have, is to get the information from the source. The young adults know themselves better than they give themselves credit for. And they know their tendencies, they know their interests, they know their strengths, they know their weaknesses. As long as we can empower them to share that, it'll be a rich conversation. We'll be able to develop rich relationships with them. So.
Exactly.
And like you said, the advent of technology, too. I mean, my students, social media is a big part of their lives. Technology is a big part of their lives. Social media, I think we know the impact that comparative analysis with teens on social media has as far as mental health. We know there's a lot of misinformation on social media about mental health, about politics, about everything. And I think the important piece for me in terms of helping them develop resilience is really impressing upon them the importance of critical thinking skills and really showing them how to think critically, how to really research a source of information to see whether or not it holds truth.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Super important. Mom, I really liked your summary, and you kind of summarized the book too. So that was really great. And then talked about this really new section that, you know, the science of prevention is real. I mean, there really is a lot. Actually, just very interestingly, I've come across two studies just in the past week, one from Taiwan and one from Sweden, where they actually are required by the government to have annual kind of physical health assessments and mental health assessments and things. And super interestingly, they were finding that young people who I think at age 11 or 12 were more physically active were less likely to be experiencing mental health problems at 18, 19 years old. So can we say, you know, it caused it? No, correlation doesn't imply causation, but certainly it may be a protective factor, regular physical activity. And so, you know, we've known forever that physical exercise is good, minimizing substances, say social, all these sorts of things. But if we can tell kids, hey, you know what? Being physically active may decrease the chance that you're going to develop mental illness. That could be persuasive. So some really interesting new research that I think can teach us something.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I mean, with one of the things I've discovered about adolescents is they know all of them don't respond to traditional talk therapy. It's you need to really do some creative means. I mean, I've told my students, if you're working with somebody who likes basketball, go out on a basketball court and shoot baskets and talk about what's going on in their lives. You know, just meet them where they're at. I mean, they're hands-on. They enjoy physical activity. It's a way for them to work out stress. So why not?
Totally. No, it's so important. And as you said, many of them will never go to therapy. For all of our books, frankly, we don't think your typical teenager is going to go to Amazon and say, what do I do because my mom has bipolar disorder or whatever else? But that's the whole reason, actually, that we made these books available that anyone can access them. So they don't have to go to the library. They don't have to go to the bookstore. Anyone can just download it because they may not even want to tell someone, but they may want to be able to read a book and find a resource. Or they live in rural areas, huge issues with access or insurance or all stigma. So many things, right, that prevent people from getting help. So what we call our books are kind of support groups in a book because they have a lot of quotes from people with lived experience in our teen book from teens whose parent has mental illness. In our adult book from parents, siblings, partners who have a loved one with mental illness. So it's not just us speaking or the research speaking, but people who've been living the experience that we hope that readers can relate to.
And Michelle, I'd like to add that our books are also interactive.
Yes, thanks, Mom.
You could call it a workbook, but we never would because we think that's a great way to find our book in the trash can. But because who wants to do a workbook on mental health, especially? But there are opportunities for our readers to write, to process, to get things down on paper. And we talk about the importance of that and the whole process of writing, not typing. And so we do allow our teens that opportunity. And we say, if you want to go ahead, don't worry about grammar. Don't worry about complete sentences. You know, just get some stuff out if it feels good. Yeah. And so far, I think we've gotten really good reports on it working well for our teens. And also the way it's laid out, we worked really hard with our wonderful designer, Jay Monroe, who made it very accessible to look at. It's not like a textbook. It's not real dense. We added some color to it. And I think just looking at it, it is kind of chunked up. So that's kind of the educator in me wanting it to be easy to take a look at. And each chapter has beginning and middle and an end. You don't have to read the whole thing front to back. Each chapter works as it's written. So we just hope that it will help these teens who are sometimes confused, angry, embarrassed, unsure of what to do.
Mm-hmm. And we have kind of some neat stories. Interestingly, some other countries have more financial support and organizational support for these young people than the United States. For example, we've been in contact with some psychiatric nurses in Iceland who are using the book with their family days They gave it to this one young person who said, this is for me. She was so excited to have a book actually for her. And so that just kind of affirms us. It's like, yeah, there is such a gap. And so hopefully some people in Alberta, Canada are going to be translating it to French. And so we're certainly getting some out to Australia and different places. And so we, other places, like just here's an example, Dave, just like 2 weeks ago in the United Kingdom, they just passed a law as part of their Mental Health Act. Their law said that when an adult is involuntarily admitted to the hospital for psychiatric reasons, they are now required to ask if the person is a parent, if they have children, and then basically check in, how are the kids doing and do they need help and connect them with resources? I mean, this doesn't sound like rocket science, right? but now it's actually a law which can help them have leverage to have funding and to requirement and check if they're doing it. In our country, I don't believe we have any such law. And I wish that we could learn from the Brits in this, because I think even something as basic as that would take us a long way in terms of really trying to help people when they're in this acute time of crisis.
Yeah, I think we can learn from other countries who are a benchmark for doing it better than we are. And I'm sure, there are several countries that are doing both healthcare and doing mental health care much better than we're doing it in the United States.
Yeah. So we have, really been pleased and to learn from different models and how they're doing it. And again, their whole organizations, their whole funds, their whole sorts of programs to support these children. And so I've honestly approached NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, at a national level repeatedly, and this is just not their focus. It's just not their interest. And as you said, prevention is hard to fund. It's hard to get excited about. It's hard to put money in. But this is our next generations of folks with mental health problems. So, you know, it seems to me to make sense, but it's hard.
Well, you know, we talk about generational trauma, and the only way you're going to break the cycle of generational trauma is if you do prevention with the generation that you're working with to break that cycle.
Exactly. Absolutely. I'm sure you talk about that with your students. It's like, yeah, we have opportunities here, folks. You know, as part of our mission is that despite, you know, the clear evidence, and I won't go off on a tangent here, but you know, there's clear research showing that parental mental illness impacts parents, impacts the kids, impacts family functioning. Despite this clear data, oftentimes these children are not even seen, not even recognized. And so our mission, our mantra, is it's time to see and hear and support these young people.
Yeah, and particularly in terms of if everybody's really concerned about the parents' well-being and they exclude the kids in that definition, these kids are going to believe their mental health issues are disenfranchised, that they're not worthy of being heard. It's the same thing with sibling grief. You know, if everybody's worried about the parents, the siblings say, well, you got to be good for your parents. And the siblings ask, well, what about me? What about my relationship with my brother or sister? Isn't that important? Their grief, like their mental health issues, now becomes disenfranchised.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally. Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. So, and, you know, we do need to name, there's an elephant in the living room we've not mentioned yet. That is the very understandable fear that parents may have that if they do acknowledge that they're having parenting problems or difficulties with their children, that their children could be taken away from them. Research does show that parents who are struggling with mental health problems are at 8 times higher likelihood of having Child Protective Services or CPS involvement. So there's some truth to this. And sadly, that's often experienced as a punitive, punishing, ripping your kids out of your hands sort of approach, which of course is the opposite of what we want. Of course, children need to be safe, but how can we instead empower parents? How can we support them? How can we help them have resources to be more effective so they can embrace perhaps what is their most important role in life of being a parent rather than seeing it as a scary thing. I use this phrase, don't ask, don't tell, because some therapists, some clinicians, like, I didn't want to ask because what if there's a problem? What do I do? I don't have any resources to give them. You know, do I need to make a childish report? All the sort of stuff. I was talking to some psychiatrist the other day and they were saying, well, just send them to the social worker if there are family problems. I'm like, no, we need to have everybody asking about, do you have kids? This is not just a role for social workers or psychologists or things like this. So really need to shift the perspective, I think.
Well, and I think we have to have many individuals in the United States or communities buy into the fact that it takes a community to take care of a child's and a family's mental health. It isn't just one person.
Everybody
is responsible. Everybody is vested in that family's well-being.
And it would be even nicer if that community of professionals talked to each other, which doesn't happen very often because we have siloed healthcare, right?
Yeah, the concept of interdisciplinary tends to have different meanings, and we are not as interdisciplinary as we think we are.
And I mean, certainly some places like the VA, I worked in the VA a long time. That was a great opportunity of people literally interdisciplinary and working together. You didn't need a release because they're part of the VA system. They're down the hall for a year in there. Not that the VA system doesn't have some challenges, of course, but, you know, there are systems such as that or Kaiser, you know, that has a large integrated healthcare system that can really do that. That's not everybody's experience for sure. It's not most people's experience, I would say.
No. And if we're going to improve the physical and mental well-being of everybody in this country, we need to take an integrative approach.
Wow. I agree. It's hard having worked in integrated care for 7 or 8 years. It's hard to have funding, to integrate mental health in that. And so we've got to find a way to make that work financially.
Yep.
We're getting a little off topic, I know. But, all this, I think, goes together. And I've fully agree. Everybody needs to see themselves as a family champion. Yeah, you don't have to be an expert in family therapy. Fine. But we want every person to even ask, do you have kids? How are the kids doing? Some basic questions such as that. Yeah. And I said, that's why I love what UK is doing. It's like they have to ask, do you have kids? Yeah. How are the kids doing? How can we connect kids with resources?
Yeah. Yeah. It sets a definite message that mental illness is truly a family disease.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely, because it is. Absolutely.
Yep. So, like I mentioned prior, didn't get a chance to read your book, but I am going to read your book and share some information down the road once I get done reading it. But I know in your book, you have a section on how teens can manage their own risk and build resilience. So talk about what it looks like for a teen to manage their own risks. And what are some ways that teens can build resilience in a situation where parents are struggling with mental illness or any other form of trauma?
Mom, do you want to start or would you like me to?
Why don't you? I'm looking at that chapter right now.
Excellent.
Go right ahead.
All right. So some of the things you think. Learn from a reputable source about mental illness. Just because you feel anxious before having to give a speech does not mean you have a mental illness.
Yes.
So let's not over-pathologize everyday emotions. So learn about mental illness. It's great to have ongoing relationships with healthcare providers who can monitor over time and be able to monitor or watch for things. Be aware of early warning signs. Certainly things that are severe, such as, if you're hearing voices, you're having thoughts of hurting yourself or things, these are severe sorts of signs that you'd want to get help quickly. But other things, having a hard time sleeping or not having much appetite or withdrawal or things like that, just monitoring them and having someone that you can talk to about those things. As Mom said earlier, focusing what you do have control over rather than what you don't is huge. And then we have a list of about 5 things. Mom, do you want to share those 5 things that we talk about that are especially helpful?
I think you just talked about them. Learn about mental illness.
And then the next one is in terms of lifestyle behaviors.
Be aware of early warning signs and don't overinterpret. Seek help early, which you just talked about. Make healthy lifestyle choices. And I said to you, Michelle, we can't say get exercise, get enough sleep, and eat healthy. Everybody knows that would be insulting to our reader. So we kind of phrase it around research shows that, and you being such a researcher. Like we said, we know you know this, but research actually says this is incredibly important. And we do have a sliding scale for them to write how much exercise are you getting? What are you getting enough sleep? So they can actually put on paper how they're responding to that. And then after you take a look at that, are you ready to make a change? Are you ready to do something differently than you're doing now? Be more active, reduce your or avoid alcohol, drugs, and building resilience to cope with challenges. And kind of in a nutshell, we have 5 little boxes here that talk about relationships, how important it is for them to be social, to accept all of their feelings. They're not good or bad, but they tell us important things to make those lifestyle choices we just talked about. Activities and schedule, make sure you make time to play, to relax, to study, and your mindset, how you can give yourself good messages and good self-talk, how important that is. And we tell these kids you're going to be okay. You've got people to support you. You've got resilience, and take good care of yourself. We hope that that helps.
Yeah, it's tricky because we definitely don't say you will not develop mental illness. We actually are very honest and say you are at higher risk. That doesn't mean you for sure will. Like with parental psychosis, there's 80% chance that you won't. So we're absolutely not saying for sure. We're honest, but we try to be very empowering and say lots of things that you can do. The other thing that I know we wrote, but I'm not sure we've said yet today, is the incredible importance of having at least one person that you can count on. You know, having a person maybe outside the family, given that the family system may be so focused on that, but being a neighbor, an aunt, a coach, a choir teacher, whomever, someone that you can really count on and talk to. Actually, just a colleague and ours, we were presenting last week at the NAMI Minnesota conference. And she was sharing her own journey of parental mental illness. She's an adult now, but her own experience of both parents experiencing mental illness. And what she says very openly is, if only I'd had somebody, if only I had some adult outside to walk through this journey with me, what a difference that could have made. So finding people in your world, because oftentimes people want to support you, but maybe don't know what to say or what to do. Or maybe you're like, okay, I'm worried that my neighbor or these friends may be having something going on, but what if I'm wrong? What do I do about that sort of situation? So, you know, being open to people in your community who can support you.
Well, you know, and I think having somebody outside of the family, particularly if they've come from a different family system that models healthy dynamics, can really give that individual's coming from an unhealthy situation another frame of reference.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I've talked to individuals who came from unhealthy family situations, and they avoided a lot of the dysfunction, and they were able to break through some of the rules because they had a healthy alternative. They had somebody in their support network who was showing them, hey, there's a different way. And I think to dovetail off of what Deanne said, they were ready to change. They were motivated for a different perspective, and they took it and ran with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And so people, teens, kids respond in lots of different ways. And some of them is that connecting with external supports, seeing their other options and getting support outside. Some don't do that, right? Some become more enmeshed with the family and get parentified, try to take care of their parents. Some get angry. Some people do all sorts of different things. But yeah, I think what you said is a nice way. It's tricky, right? It's like how, even for adults, how do I maintain connection and care, yet simultaneously take good care of myself? And same thing for kids, right? We don't want kids to feel responsible, but I do think kids often want to find a way to show their parents that they love them. You know, can they send them a funny meme? Can they grab their favorite candy bar at the store? Can they play with their brother or sister, take the trash out without being asked? You know, can they give a snuggle or a hug? You know, these sorts of things that it's like, there are ways you can show your parent that you care and it's not your fault. And it's not your responsibility to fix them. These are hard concepts.
It is. Even with the young adults who are in relationships that they are being abused in, that they are being taken advantage of, they'll stay longer than they should because they figure my love is going to fix this. But you know, I tell my students, you're not going to fix anybody that doesn't want to be fixed.
Right.
So all the love in the world isn't going to fix them. So.
Exactly.
If it's no longer serving you, as painful as it may be, just walk away from it. But if long-term, it may be more painful for you staying in it than walking away from it.
Yeah, really hard. Really, really hard.
Yeah.
But staying in it, you know what to expect, and you've learned how to manage and work around that. So that somehow seems safer than leaving, because what in the world is that going to look like? And who's going to support me and take care of me during that? So it's an important point, Dave. It's hard to do, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, it's the uncertainty of change. I mean, change is scary, even though we know it's going to lead to, you know, better benefits. It's still unfamiliar territory. So a lot of times we do what we're comfortable knowing, and we stay there, even though we know it's not going to serve our purposes short term or long term, but we do it because it's familiar.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So, boy, you've given us a lot of good stuff so far today. Got to ask each one of you to give us, in addition to what you've already given us, one ultimate takeaway or wisdom that you want our audience to know about families, teens, and mental illness. So whoever wants to start can start.
I'll start by saying, because I thought about this, Dave, and I think when our kids answer, we say, hi, how are you doing? They go, I'm good. No, I'm good. Depending on the intonation, of course, they may not necessarily be good. Mm-hmm. And so not to take that, I'm good, as a real indication of how they're doing, and to pierce through that exterior just a little bit gently and respectfully and see if there's something that you can address and help them with. And I just want to say one other thing, and that is when Michelle and I have given presentations, we've shown a clip of a movie called Canvas, C-A-N-V-A-S. It's kind of an old film, but just to look at the trailer is very interesting. It's a story of a mom who has bipolar disorder and her husband, and then they have a 10-year-old son. And in the clip, you'll see how the son is the mom has a psychotic break and the police arrive and all this chaos. When the child is just so separated and scared and worried and doesn't know what to do. He's bullied at school. And anyway, it correctly depicts very well the life of a child who has a parent with a mental illness. The name of the movie is Canvas. And if nothing else, take a look at the trailer.
Yeah. Yeah, you're so right. I mean, a lot of times people, you'll ask somebody how they're doing. They'll say, I'm good, I'm fine, because they don't want you to know how they're doing. It's just kind of like a facade or a cover. But, you know, we really need to be attuned to the nonverbals behind the verbal. We actually need to see not so much what they're saying, but how they're acting when you ask them how they're doing.
Actually, I love that, Mom. And I think in today's mode that young people often communicate is texting or social media, it's even harder to know, because what is a nonverbal? I was actually texting with a friend last night. She's like, I'm okay. And then she said something else. I said, well, what do you really mean by okay? And not everyone's going to do that. And then she actually shared some struggles and difficulties. Can we see behind even the words on our phone of okay? What does that really mean? So I think that's a great point. I would say, you know, Mom and I have really been spending 20 years now trying to raise awareness of the family experience of mental illness. And in some respects, it's exciting because there are many more organizations and groups and people dedicated to this. But in this specific area of teens whose parents have mental illness, it continues to be almost nothing, actually. And so we just want to say thank you, Dave, for the opportunity to join in conversation, to raise awareness. And we would just like to actually give a call to action to the listeners, the people who are watching today. And that is, you definitely know some people who are living with the situation, with families in which there's a teenager. Again, if we're saying, you know, 1 in 4, 1 in 5 kids have a parent mental illness, you know someone, be it in your house of worship, be it in your school, be it your neighborhood, be it your choir, whatever else. Our call to action is reach out and offer support. You don't have to ask. Was your dad dealing with bipolar disorder type 2? It really doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter what's going on. But we have a epidemic of loneliness. Just actually last week, a study came out from the American Psychological Association that 50%, over 50% of adults are saying that they feel not connected. So our ask to people is reach out. Even if you don't know, it's okay. It's not going to hurt to be kind. You know, say, hey, we're running to the water park. I'm thinking of the summer, obviously. You know, does your kid want to come with us or something? Or I made some extra cookies here, just drop off a plate for y'all. I had some new neighbors just move into my own neighborhood, actually, which I know there's a young person living there with serious mental illness. And so I dropped off some brownies just the other day. And they were just so touched. You'd think it was like the end of the world. It doesn't hurt to be kind, you know, to just reach out. Even if you don't know specifics, life's hard. Financial, political, lots of other things going on now. It's really hard. And so you're likely not going to hurt anything by just reaching out and offering kindness, realizing that they may be struggling, and particularly if there are ways you can reach out and support these kids or talk to teachers. Hey, what are you doing for kids whose parents have an illness? Hey, talk to clergy, talk to community leaders to raise awareness of this. We would be really grateful.
Well, and I think the more we raise awareness, the easier it becomes to talk about a topic that has been taboo in this society for so long. Mm-hmm. This is a topic that needs to be talked about.
Thank you, Dave. We couldn't agree more. Exactly.
I mean, just doing something little. It doesn't have to be anything big. It's just showing, reaching out, having compassion for your fellow human being.
Exactly.
Showing love, showing kindness, because you never know what kind of a day that person has had. And that one act of kindness can just give them a reason to go on another day. And then another act of kindness another day, and then another day. And then it just builds to the point where they become empowered to see that there is light at the end of a very dark tunnel that they've lived in or created for themselves. So,
and if people want to learn more about family experience, mental illness, or the youth or things like that, on our website, which is Seeds of Hope Books, Seeds with an S, seedsofhopebooks.com. And there's a media section that there are lots of articles and podcasts and videos and all sorts of stuff that we've done over the past year or so. People research articles, all sorts. It's all free. And so if people want to learn more, there's much more information there as well.
And I'll make sure all of the Seeds of Hope website gets in, your contact information gets into the episode notes, so it's right there.
Thank you so much. I just want people to know, because part of what we want is people to learn. Where do I go? Well, there aren't many resources out there. How do I? So Mom mentioned the movie, which is a great thing. That's educate ourselves. There's certainly some memoirs out there. Learning, educating, and talking. Because frankly, as you talk to other families or friends, you're probably going to find other people who are dealing with this too, because it's really very common.
Absolutely. If you're talking about 1 in 4 families are affected by mental illness or substance use, you're going to find somebody. Very quickly that's dealing with that. So, but anyways, are any other way to get, besides your website, any other ways to contact both you and your mom?
Oh, that's actually, there's contact us through our website. So that's the best way to contact us, is right through that. Our books are available anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere people want to get them. And there are links just to that, actually, from our website. But yeah, there's a contact us. That's the best way to reach us, right through our website. So,
perfect. Michelle and Deanne, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation. Deanne, it's great finally meeting you. Michelle has said so many great things about you. And I'm glad we were finally able to get you both on the program at the same time today. So thank you both for your wisdom, for your heart, for your passion. And I wish you well in your endeavors in the future.
Thanks so much, Dave. This has been wonderful. You've been wonderful to speak with.
Dave, thank you so much for the opportunity, and blessings to you and your continued work and helping us raise awareness. We're very grateful. So thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.